The series is about the William C. Loud family of Santa Barbara, California. For 7 months, from May 30th, 1971, to January 1st, 1972, the family was filmed as they went about their daily routine. They are not the American family. They are simply an American family.
I'm Mark Levitt, and welcome to Action Speaks, underappreciated dates that changed America, produced by AS220. Today, our topic is the 1973 PBS series, An American Family, based on 300 hours of raw footage taken from the lives of the Bill and Pat Loud family of Santa Barbara, California. Edited into 12 one-hour episodes, An American Family was rated number 32 on TV Guide's 2002 list of the greatest television shows ever. In its time, An American Family became a lightning rod for America's cultural debates, blurred forever our distinction between the private and public, and is considered by many one of the earliest examples of reality television.
Reality TV is kind of the evil spawn of the American Family series, because the American Family crossed certain barriers of intimacy in its filming.
I believe the star of the film is cinema verite. I don't believe it's the Louds. I don't believe it's the divorce. I don't believe it's the gay son. I think it's the fact that you see life unfolding before you and you believe it's live.
It's interesting that the Louds didn't talk about politics, because this is one of the most intensely and densely political moments of the whole post-war period.
Then there was an idea that, all right, maybe TV can show the public the private. Whereas now I think people want to get on reality TV to perform themselves, and that's what asserts them as really real.
To help us to more fully appreciate the importance and implication of An American Family are our panelists. Alan and Susan Raymond were the filmmakers for An American Family. Academy Award-winning filmmakers, the Raymonds, have created feature-length documentaries about dyslexia, schools in the era of No Child Left Behind, Children at War, and the rise of Elvis Presley. They have been selected for the Television Academy Archives as Emmy TV Legends and received the International Documentary Association Pioneer Award in 2010 for their complete body of work. Their films have been broadcast on PBS, ABC News, HBO, and the BBC. Robert Self is Associate Professor of History at Brown University, teaches and writes about 20th century U.S. history. His first book, American Babylon, Race and the Struggle for Post-War Oakland, was published by Princeton University Press in 2003. It won 4 professional prizes, including the James A. Rowley Prize from the Organization of American Historians. He is currently at work on a book about gender, sexuality, and political culture in the United States from 1964 to 2004. And Lynn Joyridge is an associate professor of modern culture and media, also at Brown University, where she has taught film and television studies, as well as gender and sexuality studies, since 1999. She is the author of Reviewing Reception, Television, Gender, and Postmodern Culture, and a number of other articles and books, chapters on film, television, feminism, queer and cultural studies in various journals and anthologies. She is also a co-editor and member of the editorial collective of the Media and Cultural Studies journal, Camera Obscura. I welcome you all to Action Speaks, and I have to say I'm quite excited about this show, and I hate to tell you, but I saw the show when it came out. So it shows you my age a little bit, but also my interest to have a show on this particular topic, because to tell you the truth, it was compelling television. Why should we study this? Why do we care about An American Family now, 40 years after its initial production? Robert Self?
Well, I think we care because the 1970s is a pivotal moment in the history of not just the family as a social unit, but the family as a source of political struggle. And by the end of the 1970s, Americans are really fiercely divided politically over the future of the family and the role that family ought to play in the nation's life and culture. It's a really pivotal decade for the thinking about the family as both a social unit and a political unit.
Lynn George, why should we care?
We should care for lots of reasons. I would, further what Robert said about the family being a sort of pivotal going through a kind of pivotal, formative, and transformational stage at that point. But also, television was going through pivotal, transformational stages at that point, not unrelated to the family, because the way that the family is so central to television and television has become so central to the family. So I think, you know, again, the way American Family sort of articulated the or tried to change the relationship between TV and the family is really interesting. And then obviously this text is hugely central to even thinking about what different forms of media are. So, you know, is it the first reality TV show? Is it documentary on television? Is there a difference? How do we categorize those things? What difference do those categories even make to the way we think about what we're seeing? So, you know, for that reason, again, hugely important.
Alan and Susan, can you tell me what American Family was so that people out in the audience who haven't seen it can kind of visualize in the mind? And can you also tell us your role in the making of an American Family?
The original concept, as told to us by Gilbert, was that we were
Gilbert
gonna,
was the producer?
Right, that we were going to document American family life. And he had chosen this family, and we were just going to get out there and film their daily lives. And I have a background of sociology and ethnographic filmmaking, so I thought I was Margaret Mead. And I thought this was going to be great, because I was just going to document what they did every day. But it turned out otherwise. There, other things happened, and maybe Alan, you want to contribute.
Gee, I mean, this is such a complicated question. I mean, well, first of all, I do want to also add in passing, because I don't think anyone has said it, that the oldest son of the family, Lance Loud, was openly gay. At that time, in 1973, there had been no real gay people ever on television. So he has the distinction of being the first real-life gay person. And I think his role in the series was, I like to think of it as kind of a cultural lightning rod, sort of like Elvis in the 50s going on and, you know, playing rhythm and blues and early rock and roll on TV and sort of shaking people up. I think people really responded to him. Some disliked him. I think a larger group of viewers really loved him, and he was for them a kind of symbol of kind of an outsider and whose lifestyle, you know, presaged the whole gay rights movement. The reality TV thing has always been, to me, a very tricky question. I like to say, and not as a joke either, that reality TV is kind of the evil spawn of the American Family series, because the American Family basically crossed certain barriers of intimacy in its filming and its depiction of what turned out to be a somewhat dysfunctional family or marriage that kind of presaged, I guess, a lot of what we see today. But you have to understand that at the time it was made, you know, it was done as a quote-unquote serious cinema verite documentary. And I think historically it would be a decade or two before any other television programmers would figure out how to capitalize on it with, I guess, the real world. Mm-hmm. And lastly, I think that the conflict that developed during the filming between Susan and myself and the producer, Craig Gilbert, over the treatment of the family and how we believe and maintain to this day they were, to some extent, especially Pat Loud, manipulated and coerced by Craig into doing certain things for the filming, sort of presaged, I think, this idea of kind of using real people, but then having someone on the production team kind of give them some, you know, direction or advice, which is something any code of ethics of documentary filmmaking will tell you you never do, you know.
Robert?
Yeah, no, I just wanted to actually pose a question to the Raymonds based on that, because we were talking before the show started about the tradition of cinema verite out of which they come, and the tension between that tradition out of which they come as filmmakers and what the producer was attempting to do, which really, as Alan says, presaged the reality television. But that tension itself is embedded in the process of making the film, and I wonder if they could...
Here's the schism. The cinema verite is, as I know it, you go in and you basically have a camera and it shakes
right.
a lot and it looks like you're
yeah.
watching everything that goes on. Is that correct?
I mean, at its essence, cinema verite is basically observational filmmaking. The idea is you try to do it as unobtrusively and as minimally as possible, using, you know, available lighting, handheld camera equipment, et cetera, sound equipment as well, to try to capture, you know, an unfettered reality that, yes, then is edited, but at the same time, presumably is a fairly accurate depiction of, you know, life as it is unfolding. So you don't, in that kind of filmmaking, for example, do conventional things like direct interviews. You let what happens happen. And for us, at least, that experience was a seven-month-long one, meaning that we filmed from May through the end of the year. And during that time, you know, shot hundreds and hundreds of rolls of film, which was then edited down by another team into 12 hours. And the idea, I guess, was that, you know, that 12 hours sort of encapsulated or preserved, you know, in an edited form, you know, what we had observed as filmmakers as we watched the Louds' lives unfold.
Lynn?
Yeah, I guess from a film and television studies perspective, you know, I guess the one thing I would want to sort of state, you know, in terms of thinking about media is, by definition, all media forms mediate, right? So there's always some framing of the real. There's nothing that ever gives you direct access, right? Right. There are sort of the more traditional documentary form with the kind of voice of God narration that explains to people what they're seeing in interviews, et cetera. I think that cinema verite was developed in opposition to that, to try to give more of that sense of the everyday. So they're all sort of ways of trying, of capturing viewers by bringing them into a sense of reality, but they're all mediated. So, you know, it's not that one is more real than another, but they're different forms. And I think what's so fascinating about An American Family...
Well, I would disagree. One is more real than another, I think.
I'm not saying that they're equivalent. I'm saying that I think that it's important to see them all as mediated, but they're mediated in different ways.
I think that what you have to understand, that the word that we're looking for here is uncontrolled reality.
Right.
In other words, the filmmakers are not controlling anything. And that's, you know, what the heart of the real cinema verite filmmaking process.
Let's listen to what Brad Gilbert says about the filming and about the effect of the filmmaker on those that were being filmed.
There is no question that the presence of our camera crews and their equipment had an effect on the Louds, one which is impossible to evaluate. It is equally true that the Louds had an effect on us, the filmmakers.
So you're filming for 7 months with this group of people. You didn't have any effect on what they said and how they said it.
This is significant because this is unequaled in any other film. No one has filmed the same subjects daily for 7 months. It just doesn't, there's no other phenomenal. There's other great cinema verite films that I admire, but no one has done this exercise that we did with the Louds. And in some ways, it was like a Zen moment. Every day, we would show up at 9 or 10, and we'd film 12 hours straight to 10 p.m.
Describe the physicality of the house, where you went to, what was the community like?
And we had these cinema verite understandings that we wouldn't ask them to do anything. Like if they walked into the room when we missed it, or the sun was coming in from the window, we didn't say, could you do that over, wait till I get the shade down. Never gave them direction. They never asked us, how am I doing? Was that okay for you? There was no communication. There was no talking to them when the camera was on, and you just lived their life and just watching what they were doing and not commenting on, not judging, not making any directorial thing. For instance, they never watched the news. They never talked about the news. Some of the critics would say, oh, because the Vietnam War was raging at this time. There were never any discussions in that 7 months about the Vietnam War. So we didn't suggest to them that they should do that. We never did any of that. And when you like that clip when Gilbert says it has an effect on us, I remember it was in October, which is way far into the shooting. It was in Santa Barbara's a very beautiful place. Every day is like heaven. You know, it's 72 and the sky is blue. So I get up and it's a beautiful day and I say, oh, what am I going to do today? Oh, I'm going to do whatever Pat Loud does today. Whatever she decides is what I'm going to do.
And today
is tomorrow.
There was a kind of Groundhog Day element to it. But I also wanted to add one more point, which I didn't get to add. You also have to form a relationship with your subject. But what we didn't do, in addition to not telling them to, you know, watch TV or talk about political events, is we didn't give them any life advice. In other words, as it became apparent during the filming that the marriage was disintegrating between the husband and wife, Bill and Pat, we did not choose to take sides or to take one of them, you know, and say, why don't you do this or why don't you do that? That was something that developed with the producer, and this gets back to the mm-hmm. original premise of the seeds of reality TV mm-hmm. and the conflict that developed.
I've watched this film so many, I'm 40 years now, and I've made 5 films on it. And I really, it's a phenomenon. American Family is a phenomenon. And I believe the star of the film is cinema verite. I don't believe it's the Louds. I don't believe it's the divorce. I don't believe it's the gay son. I think they helped. I think it's the fact that you see life unfolding before you and you believe it's live. And that's the type of filmmaking that it was, and that's what makes it exceptional and last so long.
Robert?
Yeah, I just want to build on this a little bit and fill in some of the historical context. And I take Susan's point, absolutely. And it's interesting that the Louds didn't talk about politics because this is actually in contrary to that. It's one of the most intensely and densely political moments of the whole post-war period. It's actually the early 70s is a kind of foundational moment. It's really what we think happened in the 60s, much happened in the early 1970s. So if I could just kind of contextualize, and it may be one of the reasons why An American Family has such a long life, because it's this time capsule of a moment. So the Stonewall riots in New York had happened just 2 years earlier. The gay liberation movement is just beginning to build and reach a kind of crest. Literally the month that An American Family debuted on PBS, the same month as the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the Equal Rights Amendment is being debated furiously in state legislatures across the country. There are debates in Congress over government-supported child care. There's the Vietnam War, the My Lai Massacre, and the trial of William Cowley had just taken place in 1971. This is an extraordinary political moment in American history. That's right. That's right. And despite the sort of apolitical nature of the family, Americans are thinking, right, those who are watching the show at home are thinking about these questions, about women's rights, about the women's movement, about divorce, and the question of the future of the American family. This is on the minds of the viewers, even if it's not on the minds of the Louds yeah. themselves.
And I would want to add that, you know, again, to bring TV history into that, I mean, television from its inception has had this both very strong tie to notions of liveness, again, often artificially produced, but the idea that this is a medium that will bring you things live, both through news shows, but even through something like, you know, narrative forms, sitcom forms, the sense that, like, each week you kind of check in to see what they're up to, and now what are they up to, and now what are they up to. So the sense that you're living life along with it, right? But the 70s was also a time of change in TV where it wanted to try to announce itself as more relevant. So you got the rise of shows like All in the Family that really, again, tried to shift what counted as a TV family. All in the Family, actually, the first show on TV that had a gay person in it, even before Lance, but that was a fictional right. character who came on.
Well, I think we also just have to understand the context of American family shows, that family shows in the 50s and 60s were the Donna Reed Show, the Nelson Family, yeah. Leave It to Beaver, families where there looked like there wasn't major problems at all in the up-and-coming 1950s, 60s consumer republic. The only problems were small problems that could be resolved quite easily in 30 minutes. They weren't problems of a deeply psychological nature, not problems of someone coming out within a culture that didn't support that, and not problems having to do with marriage and divorce.
Yeah, I think that that's true. But I also do think that sometimes when you go back and look at those shows, they're actually more complex than our kind of nostalgic memory of what 50s families were like.
I thought Leave It to Beaver had a lot of complex underpinnings.
Maybe not, but something like I Love Lucy. I mean, there's a constant gender struggle going on in I Love Lucy. And also what's sort of interesting about a lot of those early sitcoms like I Love Lucy, Burns and Allens, even like the Nelson families, again, there's this weird conflation between the TV family and the real family, because those weren't real families. Like Lucy was really married to Desi, who really, right, that they were a real family. So what American Family did is sort of pulled that apart and really let people think about that in interesting ways, and that, like, right, really interesting ways.
Exploded.
Right.
Susan. But also, I just want to say a couple of things. First of all, superficially, the Louds did mimic a lot of the television families. They were extremely good-looking, and they lived in a kind of middle-class, affluent lifestyle in Southern California. And I also think that it's interesting to say that the television landscape is much smaller. There are only three networks, PBS, which is in its nascent stage, and a few independent channels. So people, you know, were flipping around, and all of a sudden they hit on this kind of strange show. And the verite technique, although it had been used, you know, in many, you know, fine films prior to that, I don't think was widely known by a mass audience, by millions and millions of people. But all of a sudden, you know, as we've said, you know, this intimate family documentary series comes on. And I think people watched it like they did watch the regular television dramas and series.
But actually, yeah. I think the way they responded to it was slightly different. I don't think people watched Leave It to Beaver or Donna Reed Show and critiqued the characters in that and use it as an exemplar to project one's own frustrations, disease with the American family. And yet, when this came out, the entirety of media was devoted to criticism.
There's two topics. There's what the audience saw and what the critics saw. And that's where the media critics became really harsh, extremely harsh on the family. However, the other part of the story was the audience liked the Louds. The media hated the Louds, but the audience liked the Louds. They had the highest rating PBS has ever had. It was 8 million a week watched the Louds. I mean, dinner parties were constructed around Thursday night. You know, you had to watch the Louds. New York cartoons and Doonesbury cartoons. It was this media circus. And they wrote trashy, nasty, crude, nasty things about the family that today, you know,
also,
don't
the cinema verite technique was vilified when people felt this had crossed certain boundaries, you know, and, you know, there are a couple of very powerful sequences in the series, the big one being obviously the so-called big divorce scene where Bill comes home from a business trip, and Pat tells him she wants him to move out of that house and that she intends to divorce him. And prior to that, there's also another very intimate scene where Pat talks to her brother and about, you know, her husband's history of adulterous behavior. And these were things that, you know, like people that, you know, we shouldn't be doing this. You know, this isn't right. And it was like almost kind of like this sort of stodgy sort of Victorian, you know, critical response to really what was, you know, I believe, you know, at the time, a groundbreaking show.
Well, especially
show.
Considering Victorian propriety, a lot of the criticism was leveled at Lance.
Definitely.
Who was quite an out gay young man who had been greatly affected by Andy Warhol, had written Andy Warhol letters when he was 13, and actually the first part of the film was him living at the Chelsea Hotel, visited by Pat, who says, "I was so surprised when I got to the Chelsea Hotel. I thought it was going to be just simply a little British type of bed and breakfast with flowers everywhere," and yet she ends up meeting Hartley Woodlawn, who had been in a number of Andy Warhol films. You're listening to Action Speaks. We're here in Providence, Rhode Island at AS220, and we're talking about the seminal work of television, PBS's in 1973 release of An American Family. We're talking to Alan and Susan Raymond, filmmakers for An American Family, Robert Self, Associate Professor of History at Brown University, and Lynn Joyrich, an Associate Professor of Modern Culture and Media, also at Brown University. We have here John Terry. One of the great things about living in the state of Rhode Island is that there are all sorts of wonderful people who segue constantly into our topics. And John Terry teaches at RISD filmmaking, but he was also filming Lance Loud in Paris. Could you tell us a little bit about what did you film and what did you think of Lance?
I considered it first prize to get to film Lance. I only had to bond with one person. And Lance was a nice, exciting, lightning kid. And I had no real exposure to the gay world before I met Lance. And so I got to film Lance in New York, Paris, and Denmark. Lance and I became friends, and after the filming, Lance came to visit me and my wife with some of his friends. And Lance was a nice young man, but having Lance around is really quite a trip. Lance would go out and come home with and bring in the cab driver that brought him home and, you know, turn on the cab driver. And, you know, we liked him, but it's not who you expected to have coming into your house. I mean, some of these people, I didn't want to know them to know where I lived. But Lance and his friends were very nice people. And it's actually very hard to film people you don't like. So if you can like them, it is a big plus, and it makes your work very easy. And it was not hard to like Lance at all.
Thank you, John. So Lance Loud and Pat Loud, the mother, some people say are the stars of this show, that somehow they held it together. Lynn?
They really register, you know, between them, really interesting changes in what was going on at the time. And again, in what was going on with TV, with, you know, beginning to really bring out issues of gender and issues of sexuality. It's just fascinating, I think, even what registers as a quote-unquote coming out narrative, which I think is very different in the way that it works in An American Family, the way compared to how that's defined now, right? That in a way it was Lance saying, you know, I'm going to the Chelsea Hotel. That was the moment of coming out. It was much more about a kind of alliance with a community in a way, so and a kind of performativity that he did. So it's, I think, just a kind of fascinating representation of sexuality.
He came out for you. He came out for you as the viewer. Lance was out at 11.
Yeah. What's interesting to me about this discussion, this conversation, and to go back to the political piece and Lynn's point about the coming out narrative in American Family being represented in terms of attachment to a community, mm-hmm. rather than a kind of just individual, right, individual expression, that's crucial at this moment. And so whether An American Family imagined it or not, it intersects with a moment in the history of gay politics that's really crucial, right? So in the 1960s, the gay movement, which was very small, it was called the homophile movement. In part, it was called the homophile movement because gay leaders wanted to downplay, they didn't say homosexual, in part because they wanted to downplay the sexual quality, right, of gay and lesbian communities. Those politics were quite robust in the middle 1960s, but they were very much framed in terms of a kind of sexual respectability. But by the time you get to 1971, it's really not that long, right? And Lance is a different generation. And now gay politics is not about respectability. It's about projecting an identity into the world as a political force. And Lance embodies that in all of these ways. And so it's, once again, it's this kind of moment when American Family intersects with the political transformation of the country.
But Lance, the gay community didn't think Lance was a great role model. He wasn't the kind of young man that they wanted. You know, as I always make the comment, they wanted Rock Hudson. They wanted this formal, gorgeous guy to come out and say, you know, I'm
some
gay.
Parts of the gay community, right.
Yes, exactly. So Lance wasn't exactly their choice of a role model. So but even that community didn't necessarily welcome him.
I think it should be pointed out that Lance received a lot of fan mail after the series aired. Much of it was from young gay kids who identified with him. People said it was, you know, I was a 13-year-old kid living in, you know, Iowa and thought I was the only kid like me in the world. And all of a sudden I saw this television series and saw Lance and I realized that, you know, I wasn't. But also some straight kids who were maybe outsiders mm-hmm. also all identified with Lance.
He was a counterculture kid in a straight family.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. And also I think it's important to understand that the family accepted him. I think part of the story of American family life at that time was that if you had a gay son or a lesbian daughter, those children would be somehow marginalized or even thrown out of the family and, you know, where they'd be embarrassed, you know, to have them. But the Louds, for all their other faults, and they certainly had many, actually embraced Lance and accepted him. His brothers and sisters did. His mother did fully. Father, you know, struggled but did so. In our film that we made 30 years later called Lance Loud, A Death in an American Family, which we made in the 2002, where Lance died of a HIV hep C co-infection. We went back to make yet another film. Bill is very kind of remorseful in that documentary, talking about, you know, how he felt about how he had, you know, treated Lance a little bit badly when he was younger. But he still accepted him, and I think that was a milestone for American culture and American television.
Building on what Robert said, too, in terms of the politics, there was a movement within, beginnings within the feminist movement that came out of the New Left, that the personal was political. The way in which you act personally, the way in which you behave personally, the way in which you see yourself personally is a political statement about the larger world that's out there. And in some ways, this show and the interest in this show reflected the way in which the American public, as well as society, the entirety of the society in general, began to realize that their personal behavior had political implications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's totally right.
I wonder if the Raymonds, you mentioned receiving letters over the years about Lance. I wonder if there were letters about Pat and what your sense of the larger public reaction to Pat was.
Well, every Loud member got their own fan mail, you know. So Pat obviously was adored, and she came, they spent a year after we left in Santa Barbara, and then she was given a book deal, and she took that opportunity to move to New York. And once she moved to New York, she was just in a whirlwind of parties. Everyone was taking her everywhere, and that was probably 74. And on the other hand, Bill Loud got many, many offers of marriage. Everybody said, like, they'd say, like, well, if she doesn't want them, I'll take them. So nobody saw Bill as necessarily a scoundrel. They thought he was a great, quite a handsome man running his own business. What's wrong with him?
They did become media celebrities for just being themselves. That whole idea that Andy Warhol espoused, I mean, became their, you know, life for better or for worse. You know, when they were attacked by the mainstream media, the newspapers, the magazine editorials, I mean, Lance was described as affluent zombies, yeah. I think, in Newsweek magazine, in the New York Times, Ann Reufe called Lance's homosexuality leech-like homosexuality and called him a Goya-esque emotional dwarf. I mean, the kind of things that I'm sure an editor with a blue pencil these days would X out instantly, but somehow they were acceptable, I guess, still in 1973. But they began to defend themselves. They went on the Dick Cavett Show, which at that time was a late-night talk show opposite, like, Johnny Carson, and, other shows as well. Delilah went on the dating. He's a contestant on the Dating Game, et cetera. Lance eventually formed a punk rock band called The Mumps that played at CBGB's, along with groups like Blondie. And
Lance appeared nude on the cover of Screw magazine.
He appeared nude on the cover of Screw magazine,
et cetera. Much to his mother's upset.
Pat actually appeared in We, also in a negligee.